Salam, dear listeners. Offering my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. This is Prem, your friend from Team Radio Sai. And as I mentioned to you last week, I'm not here and this is not a live show. I am taking a break from the Gita series. I will resume that next week when I'm back in Parthi. For now, I'm going to play for you a talk that I had the opportunity to deliver at the Satsang Hall at Prashanti Nilayam. This was a talk on a topic which is very, very important in my opinion. It is about the role, power and authority and the craving for that plays in our spiritual path. And I hope you will find it useful as I found it useful preparing for it and delivering it. As always, if you have anything to share about the content of this talk, you can always write to me. I promise to come back next week with the next episode of the Gita series where we will resume our study of the third chapter of the Bhagavad Gita. For now, here's a talk that I delivered, I think, a couple of years back in the Satsang Hall in Prashanti Nilayam. I hope you enjoy it. Thank you. I'll meet you all again next week.
I offer my most loving pranams at Bhagwan's lotus feet. And I pray to Swami that he gives us all the understanding, that he alone is the one who speaks, he alone is the one who listens. Salam to all of you. Warm good morning. I'd like to start today's talk by asking a couple of questions. Not that I'm seeking answers, but let's start by answering a few questions. And I'm not even claiming that I have the answers for them or the talk is going to be giving you answers. As spiritual aspirants, if we are asked, what is the goal of life? Probably we would say self-realization. My question is self-realization really the end, or is there something beyond that too? Is that really the last point, or is there something which happens beyond that too? The second question I would like to ask is goodness or being good really mandatory for spiritual realization? Because I've read a couple of books on the Jnana Marga, Advaita, speaks much about dispassion. It talks about being fiercely detached. It talks about tapas. It talks about austerity. It talks about extreme self-discipline. But is goodness a necessity or an essential condition to be able to realize? Well, as I said, I'm not going to answer these questions, but let's see if by the end of this talk we at least have an idea or a direction for these questions. One of the most fascinating characters in Indian mythology, in Indian ancient history, is a sage by name Vishwamitra. I'm sure most of you know the story of Vishwamitra. A very, very colorful character. His mention is there in almost every epic of the Indian culture. But he did not start off as a Brahmin. He did not start off as a spiritual man. He started off as a king. And he was King Kaushika. He was a very good man. He was a very righteous king. He ruled his kingdom very well, just like his forefathers. But the story goes that one day he and his entire one huge battalion of the army go out into the forest and they are lost. And they come across this hermitage of another great sage, Sage Vasishta. So Vasishta hosts the king and his army, which is a few thousand, a few tens of thousands of men. And this sage Vasishta, who is living in a small hermitage, provides food and drink for this entire army of the king and the king, and befitting a royal treat. So the king is very surprised. He said, where did all this come from? This seems to be such a humble hermitage. So he goes and asks sage Vasishta, how did you manage to provide for all of us? So sage Vasishtha reveals that he has a divine cow. The cow's name is Nandini, happens to be the calf of the cow Kamadenu from the heaven, which is a wish-fulfilling cow. And so is this cow Nandini. So Vasishtha says that whatever I need, the cow provides for me. And there is no limit. So the king is very impressed. He's saying, such a cow should be in my possession. Because I'm the king of the land and nobody has more needs than me. So I should be the one who possesses this magical cow. And Vasishtha politely refuses, and then there is a battle which starts because King Kaushika says, orders his men to capture the cow. And then Vasishtha is not too pleased. So through his spiritual powers, he decimates this entire army. And King Kaushika, who is a mighty king, turns back, not able to capture the cow, having lost this battle in a manner which was so humiliating. And King Kaushika starts thinking. He says, I thought I was a powerful man. I thought I had all the power in the world. But I stand no chance in front of this sage, who is single-handedly able to defeat my entire army. So he makes up his mind that come what may, he must take possession of the cow. Then he comes to know that Vasishtha is able to have that cow because he has reached the ultimate stage a rishi can reach. He has become a Brahma Rishi. So now King Kaushika's destination is clear. He says, I too shall become a Brahma Rishi. Right? So the story goes, hundreds of years of penance. And he's a very, very spiritual man. In fact, he always had a spiritual instinct within, and this was the moment it actually took off. So hundreds of years of penance, and what happens if when anybody starts doing such penance? Indra gets spooked. He says, my God, this fellow is becoming more powerful, then he might come for my position. So what does Indra do? Indra sends one of his damsels, he sends Menaka, and promptly, after all a king he is, the old vasanas are there, so he falls for this damsel, and he even fathers a child with this Menaka. But after that, the sage Kaushika realizes what he has done. Because he has lost hundreds of years of penance in the process of this family life that he has got into. So again he leaps away, goes to the forest. The story goes that he comes back. This time he is attached to a daughter that is born, who is Shakuntala. So finally settles all this, goes back, again starts penance, hundreds of years. Now this time Indra sends one more damsel. He sends Rambha. And this time sage Vishwamitra has learnt his lesson. So the moment this divine damsel comes, he curses her, saying that you shall become a stone. And after cursing her, he realizes that earlier he was a slave to his lust, now he is a slave to his anger. And in that act of anger, he has lost hundreds of years of penance. So again he returns, thus hundreds of years. And he goes through this many, many times. Then of course there is the story of Trishanku. He comes and tries to help him, spends away a lot of his tapas. So finally, it's a long story short, finally Brahma appears and says, I will designate you Rajarishi. And Vishwamitra is not pleased. So again, hundreds of years of penance. Then finally achieves that status of a Brahma Rishi. Story goes, apparently in Kailasha, Mother Parvati was asking Lord Shiva, why did you have to do this to him? We say that everybody's goal is to become a spiritual person, and here is somebody who is struggling to become a spiritual man, attain the highest realms of spirituality, and why are you trying to trip him like this? Why do you send people who bring him down every time? And then Lord Shiva says that God never does that. God never wishes ill for anybody. And then Lord Shiva says that every time an obstacle was sent to him, it was to point out a flaw that was still in him. And unless he evens out that flaw, unless he removes that flaw, he cannot progress. So every obstacle that came to him was actually my blessing which was given to him. Because otherwise, he would have never acknowledged the flaw inside him. Every obstacle that we come across in life is God's way of pointing to us there is something wrong within, turn inside. Swami would give this beautiful analogy. He said, you decide to hang a picture of Swami in your house. So what do? You hammer a nail into the wall, right? So Swami would say, you hammer the nail, and after you hammer the nail, you try to pull it out. And Swami would say, how is that logical? You want the nail to go into the wall, then why is it that after you nail, you try to pull it out, you try to shake it? Then Swami says, unless you are convinced that the nail is firmly in the wall, you will not put a picture of Swami over it. So Swami said, similarly, when God gives you an opportunity to progress, every now and then it will appear that God Himself is trying to stop you and pull you away from your path. It is only so that you can recognize the flaws within and move ahead with stronger vigor. These qualities like lust, anger, greed, hatred, jealousy, we have already designated them as enemies. We all know that they are enemies. But in the path of spirituality, there is one obstacle like that, which comes almost like the ultimate test. And that is this apparent gift which Swami gives of power and authority. Every now and then God will give you power and you will see how are you handling that power. And that is the ultimate test for spiritual evolution and the ultimate obstacle too. We all have heard the very famous quote, whenever you talk about power, they say power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And this was apparently a statement made in the 17th or 16th century by a politician. Must have made it with much experience, I guess. But for long we believed this, and much later scientists said, okay, let's try this out. Let us really see if power can corrupt everybody. Does it universally corrupt? So they did an elaborate experiment. I will not go into the details of that. Apparently what they did, they got a group of individuals, and there are some psychological tests by which you can fix the morality index of a person. It's a set of complex questions, psychological questions, and based on what choices you make for each of those questions, you'll be given a morality index. So most of them were common people, normal people going about their work righteously without any wrongdoings. So then they found that invariably everybody in the group was having a moral index of, say, I'm not telling the exact figure, I don't know what is the unit, say 8, 9. Let's just fix that at 8 and 9. So they found that there are some people who are probably at a morality index of 8, some others at 9 and 10. So they are very close numbers to differentiate as good people and bad people. Because if you go by those index, who are these people? Yeah, they are all good people. Because their numbers are not very different, 7, 8, 9, not much of difference. Then they put them through another set of tests where they wanted to study how will they work, how will they respond if authority and power is given to them. And when they did that test, they found that this difference in morality index became so much more pronounced once power is given. Which means, let's say the difference was 8 and 9, after the power is given, the morality index becomes 5 and 8. So the one who is good, but not really good, becomes bad when power is given. One who is very good, probably gets to hold on to his goodness even after power is given. And that's why, Abraham Lincoln makes a beautiful quote. He says adversity most of the men can handle. You know, most of the human beings will handle adversity. We often think, you know, the troubles are the test that man gets. So he says poverty and pain and suffering, most of the men will come out victorious. But if you really want to distinguish between good and bad, give that man power. We do an interesting experiment in chemistry usually. You know? Generally, whenever we do any synthesis of any product or something like that, you end up with a mixture of compounds. So one of the very important procedures is how do you separate out these compounds, right? Because that's the only way you will get the end product which you really want. One of the oldest methods is boiling point, melting point. You know, you do distillation. Different compounds have different boiling points. Different compounds have different melting points. So based on that, you separate. But invariably, when we do experiments, we find that the boiling point and melting point is too close. That method is not good enough for separating these people. So we do another technique. It's called chromatography. And it's a field by itself. So what do we do that? There are many, many ways of doing it. The simplest way is, we'll take a column, we'll stuff it with some material like silica gel or something like that. And then we'll pour a solution of this complex, this mixture, into that column, right? So now they will start moving as one compound. They will just start trickling down. Then what we'll do, we'll take solvents, like water, alcohol, benzene, toluene. So as we keep pouring this on top, that compound which we want, if it is more soluble, it will start separating out. And that compound which is not as soluble as the compound which we want, it will be on top. So what was not separating out, when we keep repeating this process, they will start separating out. So look at this as power being the ultimate test for your progress. At some point, you know, we're all spiritual aspirants, we're all equally enthusiastic about spirituality. I go to bhajans as many times as you go, I do as many Narayan Sevas as you do. So we're all going like, you know, shoulder to shoulder. But at some point, you will be given this gift of power and authority. So now, will you stick to power or will you move forward? Just like this compound I said, there are some things which won't move forward. They get stuck in the upper layers of this column. But there are some others which know that eventually they have to come down, and they come down. So in this spiritual journey, at some time we will be given this power as a threshold. Are we getting stuck there or are we moving forward? Why? Because power is addictive. Power is really an addiction, because you know, scientists said everything they want scientific proofs. You tell them power is addictive, out of my experience if I tell them, they will not agree. They'll say we'll test it, we'll clinically test it. So again they tested it, you know, the effect of power on the brain. And they were very, very startled by what they found, because power creates the same sensation that cocaine creates in your brain. It's as addictive as that. The same sensations that once you feel power, once you feel that authority in your hand, and if your moral index is not high enough, you will compromise anything to hold on to that power. So when we talk about greed, anger, jealousy and lust and all of this, this power seems to be like the master of all of that. Because in this desire to hold on to that power, there is, you will go to any end. And that's why in one of the discourses Swami says, especially in Kali Yuga, especially in this age, power is like the ultimate test. That's scary enough, I think, right? I think sometime in the year 2003, when Swami was in Vrindavan, we knew that Swami had a fall, right? Swami fell down. That was the first time Swami fell down, and he sustained a fracture in his thigh. And Swami did not come out for a few days. Swami was not giving darshan. Then Swami was taken to the general hospital, a surgery was done, and he came back. After coming back, literally Swami wanted to make up, right? Swami had not given darshan for a few days. So Swami was waiting to go out and give darshan. He did that as soon as he was healthy enough. But then, you know, Swami was not satisfied. Swami was feeling that I did not interact much with students. So Swami started calling them again and again and giving them special sessions. So when Swami was in the hospital for this period, there were some of these old students who had, you know, many of them had taken long leaves and come and sat in Vrindavan. They said, till Swami comes back, we will see Swami and then go back for our work. So a lot of these boys were there. So when Swami came back from the hospital, Swami called all of these boys for a special session. Swami wanted to interact with them. Swami gave them snacks and coffee and tea or whatever. And when Swami was talking to these boys, apparently out of the blue, Swami made this statement. And Swami told them, boys, do good, do seva, do whatever you're doing, but never, never aspire for power. The boys were taken aback. Swami said very emphatically, never, never aspire for power. And then Swami explained, because aspiration and pining for power will make you sin. The desire for power will make you all sin. So always be careful of that. Immediately we will say that, it's okay, it's not for us, right? Where am I going to become the Prime Minister of India? Where am I going to become some, I won't even become the local gunda, forget the Prime Minister, right? Where am I going to have that kind of power that I should be careful of power? I'd like to talk about a little bit of, let's bring this concept of power a little bit closer to us, right? What exactly happens when we have power? What exactly happens when we have the authority to do something? Within our own homes, within our own workplaces, when we say, I want power, yes, there is one thing about pride, right? I have a position in society. I can do this, I can do that. Pride is one thing, of course. Greed is one thing, of course, because power gives you enormous amount of, you know, leverage. For instance, I think in the year 2004, the Election Commission of India decided that everybody who is trying to become, trying to get elected to the parliament, will have to give an affidavit of what is their net worth. Right? Till then, the politicians never had to disclose, apparently. And when they studied, you know, the net worth declared by these politicians, they found something very, very startling. For instance, 2014 elections, more than 80% of the politicians are crorepatis. Can you imagine that? India's population is 1.2 billion and you have a parliament which is supposed to be representative of this country, and there you have 80% of politicians are crorepatis. And they found the average net worth of each politician, each parliament member of parliament, is 14 crores. That's the average. And the person who was talking about this in one of the talks, he said, thank God there is one, the former director of Infosys, Nandan Nilekani. Thank God he did not get elected, because he had 7,000 crores. This whole average would have gone haywire. But imagine, why do people who have so much in life, why do people who have earned so much, who are doing extremely well in business, why do they aspire for power? When everything is there, why do you want power? We often think that as long as I have everything that I need, food is there, clothes are there, family is there, that is enough. But that's why the psychologists say that once all these are there, then you aspire for something which is higher. When you have money, the next thing is, what should I do to retain this money? I have money, what should I do so that nobody can come and grab this money from me? For that I need power. Right? So now, bringing it to the idea of our day-to-day life, why do we really seek power? The desire to do what I want to do. Let's say I'm working in my office. Tomorrow I want to start something new in my workplace. I want the freedom to do what I want to do. And invariably that freedom comes when I am higher up in the hierarchy. Right? Either I myself am the boss or I know the boss very well. Right? Both ways. We try to reach power both ways. And always the desire for power is linked with freedom. I want the freedom to do what I want. I should be able to decide what I want to do and I should be able to do it. Now, doesn't that make power so close to our heart? Don't all of us have this desire for power? And when not allowed to do what we want to do, what happens? We get stressed out, right? They found that, you know, when you study any society, when you study a society where there is clear hierarchy, where there is a person on top, then there is a, you know, mid-level management, and then you have the executives in the lowest level. If you pick up anybody and study their levels of stress, they find that the lower you are in the hierarchy, the more stressed out you are. So the lesser the freedom that you have, the more stressed out you are. And as human beings, we are always trying to get out of stress. We are always trying to release ourselves from stress. Right? And that's what we do. Go into the traffic. Anybody comes and stops us, we violate the rule. Anybody stops us, I know that minister. I know the commissioner. I know this person. I know that person. Why? We want a certain amount of freedom. Right? I will do what I want. I don't want to be stopped. And this nature is there in each one of us. And that is why they found that invariably the social structure, why is it stable? If everybody wants to be free, if everybody wants to do what they want to do, then the whole society will be chaotic, right? Then they found that every individual finds some pocket in their life where they are the boss. So a man is absolutely stamped upon and walked upon in the office, at home he'll be the king. Right? Somebody who is very bad at home, who's probably, you know, the wife is suppressing him or the husband is suppressing the wife, when they go out in their workplace, they will try to exert that control, that authority. Because one thing is that freedom which we seek, and the other thing is the brain needs to think that I am in control, at least of something, if not of anything, at least of something. And that's why they will find that, you know, they found this in all people. Like if there's a student who is very bad at studies, he will be the hero in his sports club. He'll be the hero in his poetry club, or whatever it is. Some expression for this power will always be there. So this desire for power is there in all of us. This aspiration for power is in all of us. So that is why all of us need to be careful of power. But why does power corrupt? Like we said, yeah, morality index should be high. But why does power really corrupt? Why does power really become so dangerous? I'd like to take one small example of a system which literally broke down because of power being misused. And of course it's the system which is very, very maligned and very, very, has a very bad name about it, and that's the Indian caste system, right? It's the ancient caste system of saying that higher class, lower class, ruling class, you know, the Brahmin class, and then the worker class. And we often look at this system and say that this system failed because of the inequalities, right? And we always attack that. There is inequality. There should not be inequality. But we don't acknowledge the fact that for hundreds of years this system actually worked. For hundreds and thousands of years, the system was actually a functioning system. How was that? And something went wrong and the system collapsed. And the system had to go. I'm not saying that let's bring back the system. The system had to go. So what happened? According to this tradition, you have the Brahmins, they're supposed to be the highest class, right? And then you have the Shudras, who are the lowest class. So you have this thing, don't come into our temple, don't come into our living area, don't use our well, don't do this. Seems very discriminative, right? But if you take a look at the Brahmin class, no other community among these caste systems had as much self-discipline as them. They had imposed enormous amounts of discipline on themselves. You should have bath 3 times a day, you should do puja 3 times a day, you can't eat this, you can't eat that, you can't go here, you can't go there, you can wear only this, you can do only this. So this community, which had imposed on themselves much, much more discipline than any other community, had the moral authority to be on top. So when these people said, don't do this, people listened. People allowed them to have that authority and power. I was talking to one person who says that the detail to which it goes, let's say if your mother has passed away, then you are not allowed to eat certain things. Your father has passed away, then you are not supposed to eat on certain days. If you are a widow and you are a Brahmin, there are some restrictions. If you are a widower and you are a Brahmin, there are some things you can't do. So there was this class which had such self-discipline on itself that when they set rules, people would listen. And then come to the next class, the Kshatriyas. They are the rulers. Imagine, they are like the ones who decide the fate of the people. A king, just being born a king, being born a prince, becomes a king. He has complete judicial authority over the land. He decides what you have done is right or wrong. How did he have the authority? When an enemy attacks the kingdom, the first person to be in the defense, the first person to go out into the war field, was the king. And if the king was old, the son, the brother, the uncle, somebody, the whole family, the royal family, were the first people to sacrifice themselves when there was danger to the kingdom. It was that self-sacrifice that gave them that authority. Now, when we talk about the Ramayana, there is this incident which everybody has something to comment about. How can Rama send away Sita to the forest? Right? Somebody once asked Swami, I heard that, Swami, you say that Rama was ideal, whatever he did we have to follow. And how can we follow this? So is this how we have to behave as husbands? And Swami made a very clear explanation. He said, that act was an example for a king, not for a husband. That act of sacrificing one's own comfort and one's own desires and what one holds dear to one's life for the welfare of the kingdom is the dharma of a king. So a king who is ready to sacrifice so much, who puts himself way behind everybody else's welfare, has the authority to rule. And that is why in our Sanatana Dharma has this name for a king. A king is called Naresh. Naresh means the God among men. He is the God among men. Why? If you have such self-sacrifice, the rule that you put, the law that you put can be followed. The authority that you have can be absolute. So now does that explain? So to be able to have power and that power to not corrupt, that power to not destroy the one who's holding the power, one has to have extreme self-restraint and self-discipline and extreme selflessness. Without this, power corrupts whoever you are. I was once talking to an old student, and this person happens to be working in the armed forces, or he was working in the armed forces, and he shared a very interesting insight. He said, in the army, if you join the defense forces, be it the army or the navy or the air force, you are trained for 3 months, 4 months, rigorous training before you are given a weapon in your hand. For 3 months of rigorous training, and extreme self-discipline is hammered into you, and then you are given a weapon in your hand. But if the person is a militant, 16-year-old boy, 3 days training, the weapon is given. What is the difference? So he made this observation. He said, to give a weapon to a person and tell him, don't shoot, you need 3 months of training. To give a weapon to a person and say, go shoot, you need only 3 days training. To use a weapon, you don't need any training. Half an hour you can learn. But to have a weapon and not use it, you need months and months of training. And that is why to be able to wield power, you need extreme self-restraint, self-discipline, and extreme selflessness. So again, we're talking about the army, we're talking about people who have weapons. So does this really address our situation? It definitely does. Let's bring something absolutely close. Another system of power sharing which is collapsing rapidly. The power sharing in the own house, right? It was decided, the man decides, the woman follows. The man is the authority of the house. It was a clear example of power being misused that we are seeing that system is collapsed. Now going back to that same explanation which I gave of seeing power as, you know, the desire for freedom, the desire to control. If I can't control here, I will go control in my office. If I can't control in my office, I'll go control in my home. So what do you do with this nature that there is this, you know, desire to control something? Can we turn this desire to control inward? Can we say that I want to have control over myself? Because this aspiration is there. This aspiration to control is there. This aspiration to have authority is there. That makes up this human nature. Can we turn it inward and say, I want control over myself. I want control over my thoughts. I want control over my desires. And isn't that what spirituality is all about? Self-control. Patanjali's Yoga Sutra starts with Yama, Niyama. All of that is about self-control. How are you able to hold yourself? So this nature to control something, have authority over something, can we slowly turn it inward? So that should solve all our problem, right? You can just start doing that and we are done. There's this very beautiful story in the Bhagavatam, which apparently was narrated to Yudhishthira. Much of the very, very valuable lessons that we can learn from the epics were all dialogues in which kings were part of, because the sages would come and indulge in lengthy conversation with kings and rulers so that they learn the art of wielding power without being corrupted by it. So this is one story which was told to Yudhishthira, right? Apparently I think sage Markandeya comes and tells the story to Yudhishthira. There is this man who is sitting in penance for many, many years, hundreds of years. He's been sitting there doing penance, and with much effort he has got full control over his body, over his thoughts. So one day he is sitting under this tree and suddenly he is disturbed because there is a bird which is sitting on top. It's a crane, and it has dropped on his shoulder. Right? So he is disturbed by that and he looks up in anger. And the moment he looks up, the bird bursts into flames. So this man is really thrilled. Wow, I got something here now. Some power you have attained. In all the self-control you have attained some power. So then he is very pleased with himself, because he feels it's a sign of progress. I have achieved something. Right? So he is very happy, probably walking up in the air. Then he goes around his task of asking for alms, because he is a sage. You know, he begs for his living. So he goes to this one particular house. and he asks for alms. And he's waiting there and he's asking and asking and asking. The woman of the house says that, I'm getting, just give me a few minutes. Because the story goes that she's actually serving her husband as a dutiful wife. And this man is going impatient. How can this lady make me wait? She doesn't know I can burn a bird like this. You know, literally probably that's what would have been running in his mind. He says, she's making me wait. And so he's getting angry and angry here. So the moment this lady comes out with the food to offer, this man starts yelling at her. He said, how can you make a Brahmin wait like this? This is unbecoming. You have no idea who I am and all of that. So the lady says, calm down. I am not a crane that you can burn. He says, I am not a bird which will burn when you look at it. This man is startled. He says, how does she know? And then she says, see, I am doing my sadhana. I am doing my prescribed duty of serving my husband. So your siddhi which you have attained will do no harm to me. So this man is really, you know, humbled by this lady. And he falls at her feet and he says, Mother, guide me. I seem to be getting lost. Right? So the story goes that the lady tells him that, I am not the one who is going to be your guru. You go to such and such a town. There is one man, his name is Dharmavyada. Right? Dharmavyada. Go to him. He is a very, very wise man. He will teach you the ways of dharma, the ways of moving forward. So this man goes in search of this person. He thinks that maybe he's, you know, probably he can burn an entire city with his rage. You know, probably that's how powerful this sage is. He goes searching, searching, Dharmavyada, Dharmavyada. Where does he end up? He ends up in a butcher's shop. And this Dharmavyada is a butcher, cutting meat and selling. He's so surprised. And that's where this man learns the lesson of dharma, the lesson of karma, the lesson of doing your duty. That's how the story goes. But isn't this another problem when you start turning this sense of control inside? The moment you start doing this journey of, okay, I will not control you, I will not control anybody else, I will control my own thoughts. So Swami says that any aspect, anything that you take up in spirituality, start doing pujas for very long, start doing something for very long, start doing meditation, some amount of extra power will come. You know, little bit of mind reading, little bit of future gazing, something will come. And that is a subtle power which is given to you. Again, remind yourself, that is God testing us. You can't run away from it, right? And that's what apparently Ramakrishna Paramahamsa used to be a very, very strong advocate of, especially exhibiting powers and miracles. And that's one problem which people always had with Swami. Most of these devotees who came from the Ramakrishna cult had a lot of problem accepting Swami because Swami is showing off his powers, right? And Ramakrishna always said, don't show off your powers. So it took a lot of time for them to realize that Swami was not showing his siddhis. It was not acquired power, but it was expression of the inherent power. So when you turn within, this thing starts. Okay, now when we say, I will not control anybody else, I will not wield my authority on others, I will do it inward, I will become spiritual, now this problem starts. So again, whenever Swami speaks about, you know, freedom, when you're talking about freedom, there's one beautiful discourse that Swami gave in the year 1990 during the summer course. The title of the discourse is, What is Freedom? Right? That's the title of the discourse. But if you go through the discourse, the entire discourse is, What is duty? The entire discourse is, what is duty? And through the discourse, Swami says, there is nothing like freedom. The more freedom that you have, the more duty that you will have, which means no freedom. For instance, there was a minister in the Indian government who was once asked, what are your comments about freedom of speech? Right? We always speak of that heavy debate in democracies, freedom of speech. And she made a very beautiful statement. She says, what freedom? I have no freedom. She says, if I say something absurd to you, then tomorrow it will become a big issue in the media, then I'll have to come and apologize, retract my statement. She says, where is my freedom? And she said, the more authority that you have, the more power that you have, more willingly you have to give up your freedom. And the more willingly you will give up your freedom will happen only when you see power as responsibility. Only when we see power as duty. And that's what Swami was telling in that entire discourse. Don't look for freedom, look for duty. Because when you look for freedom, you look for power. But when you look for duty, even when power comes your way, you will look at power as a duty, as a responsibility. And the moment you look at power as responsibility, all of this will kick in. You know, self-restraint, self-discipline, selflessness. If anything happens to anybody behind me, I will be the first one to step forward. Over me, right? So the moment we start seeing power as responsibility, automatically power will not corrupt. I was talking about, when you start doing a lot of meditation, you start getting some extra powers, right? It's nothing like extra powers. It's like Swami says, that burning ember is covered by the ash. When you blow the ash, the burning ember from inside shows. It's not coming from outside. So Swami says, all your powers are inside. But when you start doing anything like this, the power starts showing from inside. But look at our daily life. When we talk about giving education to a person, there is somebody, let's say there's a person from a very poor background. So we decide to educate that child. So what are we doing? We call it empowering the child, right? Is the community there? We want to do something, give them reservations. What are we doing? We are empowering the community. So when you give an edge to a person, you are actually empowering that person. Now when we look at our lives, how much power do we actually have? The knowledge of two or three languages is a power which somebody else doesn't have. So in the hierarchy, I'm a little higher. There are so many people, millions and millions of people who don't know about Swami. I know Swami. Isn't that a power? Isn't that an empowerment? I'm a little higher in the hierarchy. And Adi Shankara says, one of the greatest gifts that is given to you, which you don't realize, is manushyatva, being born a human. Isn't being born a human a power that has been given to us? There are two things. When we don't acknowledge power, we are not prepared for the corruption that power is going to cause. Without our knowledge, we are actually falling prey to power. But if we acknowledge power too much, we say, that is power, I want it, then again it's a problem. You have to look at power as responsibility. So how do we strike this balance? I don't have an answer, but this balance has to be struck. That I acknowledge all the power that has been given to me. Being born a human, knowing Swami, being a devotee, being born in a good family, having a certain status in society, not being poor, I'm being born in a middle class, I'm again in a hierarchy a little higher. Each one of these powers, are we having the requisite self-restraint, self-discipline and self-sacrifice? In other words, bracketing all this together, purity to go with it. And if we don't, we're going to be stuck in that level for some time. So now coming to the ultimate power, right? We started off with that. Self-realization is the ultimate. That power is the ultimate. So now if I'm going to attain the state of I am God, isn't that the ultimate power which is going to be given to me? So can that power corrupt? being God, being in that state of I am one with God, can it corrupt? I'm not sure. Because there are two things. That's why knowing and realizing are two different things. I mean, I've seen a lot of people, when you're given this information, that don't worry, you're God. And that's a sudden empowerment. You're not prepared for that. Suddenly you're God. Then you'll become like, you know, in the epics you have the stories of Shishupala, Pundalika, those kind of characters, who start thinking that they are God. Why? I look like Krishna, so I am also God. So when you take this knowledge that essentially I am divine, if you don't have the requisite purity to go with it, that knowledge can actually corrupt you. That knowledge can actually make you sin. You will think that I have nothing to bind me. I have no disciplines to stop me. I can do whatever I want. And that is why when we talk about something like, you know, Navaveda Bhakti, we talk about the ultimate state is Atmanivedanam, right? When you have that self-realization, that I am divine. But to reach there, you have to go through the state of Dasyam. I am not a master, I am a servant. I am not the authority, but I am a servant of the Lord. And this is actually one of the most beautiful techniques which God has given to us. That constantly keep telling yourself that I am just a trustee. That I am not the authority. I am just a representative. I am a dasa. I am a dasa. In every situation, there is no attitude which can insulate us from the effects of power than this attitude of dasya. Why? In everything. Swami would say, you know, you're a parent. Your child's entire future is entrusted to you. Complete power. You have complete power over at least one individual. Forget the world. There's this one kid in your house. You have complete power over him. All the chances of corrupting. Right? It's absolute power. It might not be in quantity, but in quality, it's absolute power over one individual. Swami says, what does he say? Swami says, consider yourself as a trustee. This child has been entrusted to your care. This is God's child who has been given to you to take care. And that attitude will give you the balance to give best care for that child. So in each situation in our life, I become a boss. I go out in the society, you know, I'm an educated person. And I'm empowered. And I am feeling that, Swami, this is a grace that you have given me. When that thought comes, automatically responsibility will come. And that's why, you know, whenever we talk about Dasyam, example is not any ordinary fellow, right? No, he's not any ordinary servant. Who is given as example for Dasyam? Hanuman is given as example. And Hanuman is power incarnate, right? He's the mightiest warrior in the entire epic. And he is given as example for Dasyam. Well, they could have given some ordinary fellow, no? That Kevat could have been an example of Dasyam. One of the Dwarapalakas of Ayodhya could have been an example of Dasyam. Why was Hanuman given an example of Dasyam? Because when you have that Dasyam, when you have that servitude, that I am the servant of the Lord, you have this ability to contain in yourself enormous amounts of power and not be corrupted by it. The many versions of Ramayana that, you know, the South Indian version, there's the Tamil poet who writes Kamba Ramayanam, right? There's so many versions. I'm not too sure in which version this comes, but the author writes very beautifully. You know, Hanuman has gone to Lanka. He's performed such heroic tasks. He's gone and challenged the king of the Lanka. He has killed his own son. He has killed half of the army. He's come back victorious. Finally, he's coming back and he's reporting to Lord Rama. Right? And Rama has been desperately waiting for news about Sita. And Hanuman comes and Hanuman does not say, you know, Rama, you have no idea what I did. Right? I just jumped across the ocean. I just finished off these people. I killed this fellow. I went and challenged Ravana. He doesn't say any of these things. He comes and says, I saw. What a beauty. You know, he comes and says, I saw. Here is Rama who is desperately waiting. Rama and Sugriva and all of them are waiting for news. And Hanuman comes and says, I saw. One word, the news has been given. Right? And then he says, she is fine. And then he says, she is as pure as ever. So see the gradation in which he is giving. I saw her, she is fine, she is alive and she is fine. And nobody has even touched her. And then he says, by your grace, I jumped across the ocean. By your grace, I could be victorious. At no time, he is forgetting that I am the servant of the Lord. In which, when that kind of dasyam is there, because as spiritual aspirants, we cannot choose. We cannot say, tomorrow somebody comes and says, will you become trustee of Central Trust? You can't run away. Maybe you can, but at some point you have to face the authority which is given, because that is the ultimate test. You can't run away from the exam. If you want to graduate, you have to take the exam. I'd like to complete with one short piece of news which came some time back. You know, it was in news about 3 or 4 years ago. There is this temple in Kerala, Padmanabha Swami Temple. It was in 2011, it was in news. Till very recently, we thought the richest temple in the world is Tirupati Temple. But they just opened one of the vaults. They apparently have 5 vaults or 4 vaults. They opened one vault and overnight, Padmanabha Swami became the richest in the world. Right? So they are kind of going through the various vaults just to see how much wealth is there. And it's unbelievable. Unbelievable means, I was just going through the figures. They believe that if they were to conservatively estimate the value of the wealth which is there in that temple, it's about $1 trillion. And the GDP of India is $1 point something trillion. So one temple. And they've not even opened one of the chambers. They're saying we have no idea what is inside. So imagine $1 trillion in a temple, and the temple was being governed by a royal family, the Travancore royal family, and they have not touched it. And even after it was, the inventory was done, they said it does not belong to us. The government can do what it wants to do with it. They said we will not touch it. How was such self-restraint possible? I mean, I told you that this is a cycle. You know, you have more money, you want power to protect the money. Then you get power, you need more money to protect the power. It's a cycle. But how is it that this royal kingdom had such amount of power sitting under those chambers in the form of this money, but decided never to touch it? It's very beautiful. Sometime in the year 1750, one of the kings who came in that lineage, the Travancore royal family, he suddenly declared that henceforth the king is Ananta Padmanabha Swami, the deity of that temple. He says he is the king. And the royal family, all my children and the lineage that is to follow, will henceforth be called Padmanabha Dasas. He says we will be called Padmanabha Dasas, servants of this Lord Padmanabha, and he will be the king. One thing is to have this noble idea. The other thing is to pass it on to many generations. I don't know how he managed to do that. How this royal family managed to retain that attitude of we are the servants of the Lord for so many years that after multiple generations, even now they say that we are not the owners of that wealth. Imagine they call themselves Padmanabha Dasas, and it's very interesting that when the British came and took over India, they apparently would give a certain royal privilege to the kings, right? So if you're a king of a certain kingdom, you would get the 21 gun salute. And when they came to this Travancore kingdom, the king said, no, we are the servants. The king is Lord Padmanabha. So apparently Lord Padmanabha used to get the 21 gun salute for many, many years through the entire period of the British rule. And after that, when the Indian independence happened, even the Indian government recognized Padmanabha Swami as the ruler of the Travancore kingdom. Imagine that, when you have that attitude of I am not the king, I am not the power, I am not the authority, I am a servant, and this power has been given to me as a responsibility. Even $1 trillion and the power that comes with it cannot corrupt you. So this is actually a very, very beautiful message which is so beautifully hidden. And that's why I feel maybe even after you get self-realization, if given that ultimate power, the key to that ultimate power of you are divine, is it possible that God will test us even after that? And see, let's see how you, okay, you're God, I'll give you one universe, let's see how you govern it. Will it be possible? Maybe. I mean, I don't have the authority to say yes it is, but maybe. But that is why throughout this process of spiritual learning, and that's a different topic by itself, the moment you start this pair of rights and responsibilities. Even yesterday we were going through a discourse where Swami said that keep seeking responsibility, keep seeking responsibility. Look at everything that comes your way as responsibility and don't seek for rights. Because rights will come. Rights will automatically come. It's a given. But if you see what has happened today is consciously we have all made a shift towards rights. What is my right? What is my right? What is my right at home? What is my right at office? From everything, you know, even if I have to take a leave, how much I'm entitled for. So this nature of consciously seeing every power as not an entitlement, but a responsibility, is I think the best way to handle this power, because it is going to come our way. It's the ultimate test. The best way is to keep telling, Dasoham, Dasoham, Dasoham. And that's why very, very safe path. Bhakti is always a safe path. That way also you will come. Same Soham only. But this Dasoham, Dasoham, constantly safety net is there below. Right? But that is a different approach by itself, and that calls for a different set of disciplines by itself. So this is what I thought I'll share with all of you about this one particular obstacle and the test in the path of spirituality. I most humbly offer this effort at Swami's lotus feet, and thanks Swami for, you know, all of this is actually spoken by Swami. It is not somebody's brainchild. It's not my intuition or my brainchild. So thankful for Swami for coming, and you know, we were telling, sometime back we were discussing, Swami could have just come and told, think who am I, or think that you are God. But to decode that ultimate message and break it down into everyday life. If you're a mother, what you do. If you're a father, what you do. If you're a servant, what you do. If you're a politician, what you do. To break that message down to this level of tidbits that each one of us can absorb. I think we all should be very, very grateful to Swami for that. So, thanking Swami for that, and thanking all of you for your very patient listening, I conclude this talk.